Thank you for listening. This is Israel Rebound, a podcast joining listeners around the world to Israel, exploring the ties that bind us through culture, identity, and current events. I'm Alan Potash in California, and I'm joined with my co-host and friend Liz Felstern in Jerusalem. Today is 150th day of the war in Gaza, and the hostages, 134 hostages, have still been held captive. Someplace. We're not quite sure where they are. But that's not how we want to start today's podcast, Liz. There's lots of things for us to talk about. How are you?
I was going to say that's a heck of a way to get us started. It's hard to follow that with anything, really.
It is.
That is where we are. That is our reality. And all things considered, I'm okay. So good to see you.
It's good to see you as always, even though we're still challenged by the current events of what's going on in the world. But last week we talked about municipal elections, and you were going to give us a rundown after the voting had taken place and the results were made public. So let's start with that. Anything new and exciting in municipal elections?
Well, yes, we did have the municipal elections all throughout Israel. There were some cities that had sort of surprising turnover or changes of their mayor. I won't list all the cities throughout the country, but we had some places with surprising results and changes of leadership, some places that dug in and returned or kept retained, I guess is the word, their mayors. One city, I think, with something like a 97% of the vote going to one candidate, which is pretty wild.
I jump in for 1 second because my friend and mayor of Ramat HaNegev, I think he had 98%.
Oh, wow. Okay. Was anyone running against him?
I didn't ask. I just said, how did you do?
And he said 98%. Okay, well, congratulations. We have some parts of this country that are very, very divided, but apparently some where there is complete consensus about who people want as their mayor. In Jerusalem, specifically, the current mayor, Moshe Leon, was reelected, which was not a surprise. That was the expectation going into the election. We had talked about that there was this a large number of different ultra-Orthodox parties running for the city council seats. And the results of that are that for the first time in the history of the Jerusalem City Council, a majority of the seats will be held by ultra-Orthodox representatives. So we have 31 seats in Jerusalem, including the one which is the mayor's, and 16 of them are now going to be held by people from these six different ultra-Orthodox parties. There are another handful that are held by right-wing / Orthodox Zionist parties, but not ultra-Orthodox. So that, you know, also a religious camp. And then we have a smaller number that are held by secular or pluralistic parties. And we'll see what kind of topics the city council decides to take on over the next 4 years. I think it's reasonable to assume that this, you know, will have some changes in how housing gets looked at in Jerusalem, right? What types of areas are opened up and schools as well. It will be interesting.
Do you think it'll change the way Jerusalem feels as a city?
So several of the people who have been elected to the city council have made public statements that is not their intention, that they are not looking to turn Jerusalem, right? This is coming from the ultra-Orthodox members now of the city council. They're not looking to turn Jerusalem into Bnei Brak, for example. That was the quote. The feeling of the city, I mean, the city feels quite religious already, right? There are very few things that are open on Shabbat, for example. there are a limited number of non-kosher establishments. You know, could something like the gay pride parade that takes place in Jerusalem now have more controversy around it or be asked to have a more limited route, or will there be challenges around that? It's possible, right? Because that some that I choose that example because it's sort of on the cusp of how open Jerusalem is able to be as a city, right? We've had a pride parade, but each year there's some arguments around it. We had obviously a young girl murdered at it not so many years ago. So things like that, the sort of the far edge of how open and how secular or inclusive Jerusalem can be as a city, maybe we will see some changes. I don't know.
So if my memory serves me, there are more things open on Shabbat now than there were in the 90s and 80s. Is that, well, I don't know if you can speak to that, but there are more things open today in Israel on Shabbat than before probably your time.
In Israel overall or in Jerusalem?
In Jerusalem.
Jerusalem specifically? I don't know. I don't know. Usually, I can't say from experience because I don't see too much of the city on Shabbat. In general, it is something that people complain about, that there isn't much cultural things offered on Shabbat. But are there more today than there were 20, 30 years ago? Maybe.
Wasn't there a change also with transportation on Shabbat that we talked about once before?
A night line that was opened. Yes. I haven't heard more about how it's doing or what kind of a reception it had. I'll have to check in on that one.
So just going back to the change of the city council, has that been a challenge for the non-religious community? Has there been an uprising or a protest around this increase of seats within the city council, or is it just kind of status quo?
Well, it's not the status quo, but the non-religious community in Jerusalem has been sort of surprisingly quiet both before and after this election. Voter turnout amongst non-Orthodox Jerusalemites was quite low, which maybe makes sense, right, now seeing what the results of the election were. And there hasn't been a lot of sort of public discussion about what this means or people being worried or concerned. It could certainly be because people have bigger things that they're worried about right now, right? Big national existential questions that are sort of larger than the purview of a city council. But we'll see. Again, depending on what types of issues this current city council decides to take on, maybe there will be, you know, more people voicing dissent or concern around the committee, the council, should they try to push a very ultra-Orthodox agenda.
So for somebody like me or others coming to visit Israel and spending time in Jerusalem, we probably wouldn't experience any change.
No, I wouldn't expect you to, no.
But if I do, I'll let you know.
Sure, please do.
So on another, since we're talking about the role of the ultra-Orthodox in Jerusalem, I have an understanding that there's a possible discussion or vote coming soon about the exemption of ultra-Orthodox teens in the army. Is there anything that you can talk about around that issue?
This, you know, has been an issue since the establishment of the state. And I think maybe we'll share in the notes an article that gives some of the background of how this exemption originally came to be. But I'll just say that, you know, when Israel and the IDF were first founded, the number of ultra-Orthodox people living in Israel and looking for an exemption to the army was quite small. And at the time, it made perfect sense for them to be exempt because they didn't want to go to the army and the army didn't particularly want them. The army didn't know how to accommodate their dietary needs, other religious and cultural needs, and it was a good deal all around. Fast forward 75 years, and the demographics have changed considerably. The ultra-Orthodox community is very large, and enough people from the ultra-Orthodox community, though it's a relatively small number, but enough have joined the army over the years that the army realizes that this is doable. They can accommodate the needs of ultra-Orthodox soldiers. And so the original reasons for the exemption kind of no longer hold. It was up for renewal last in the fall and then was extended, and a new law is supposed to be put in place by now, by March of 2024. The Knesset would have to come to some sort of agreement around what that new exemption would look like, and they don't seem to be anywhere near that. But all of this, of course, has happened at the same time as we have a tremendous number of reservists being called up for to fight in the war. And so when a proposal went out for the age of reservists for all people in the army to be extended, this caused a little bit of an outcry. How is it that we as a country would be asking those already serving to serve longer when we have this very large group of citizens who are not serving at all? So this is, I understand, going to come up for discussion in the Knesset. It's a very heated topic with strong feelings all around, especially in the middle of a war. And it will be something for us to keep our eye on as to how the Knesset figures out how to navigate this very sensitive, very political issue.
I think so. I agree with you. And I was listening the other day to an update from, I think it's one of the Times of Israel podcasts with Chaviv Retegor, who really broke down the demographics of this and the history as well, is that this was, as you said, part of the historical agreement between Ben-Gurion and the ultra-Orthodox community that this exemption would mirror the fact that this population would be studying Torah and Talmud. And for some people, that's the equivalent of enlisting in the army. Most people, I think, would challenge that. But the percentage, as you talked about, of the numbers has grown significantly since 1948. The ultra-Orthodox population was relatively small at that time. And now it's, I think, 13 or 14% of the country. And he used a number, Aviv Retegor did, and I'll have to find out just to make sure, and I'll put it in the notes, that a recruiting class today of the ultra-Orthodox community would be about 60,000 individuals, which is a significant number. And he also
turning 18 each year, yeah.
And he also referenced that there were about 500 that at the start of the war on October 7th, you know, enlisted. A very small number, but again, a sign. But his conversation that he had dealt with that the opposition by the leadership of the ultra-Orthodox communities is that the soldiers would not be able to maintain their religious quality of life. And I think that's the challenge that the army has, to be able to ensure that the quality of life of a religious individual can be met in the army.
I don't know to what extent we could really say we are maintaining the quality of life amongst non-religious soldiers either, right? Serving in military, especially during a war, is not known for, you know, having the most quality of life aspect to it, but it is necessary to defend and maintain the state. Question is that a burden that all citizens should be taking upon themselves equally? You know, the argument to that is that ultra-Orthodox people who are studying Torah are in fact, right, protecting Israel in their own way, which is a, I think, a valid viewpoint, but it's hard to justify at a time when there are more clear and present threats, right, that have to be dealt with through the more traditional type of defense.
It just goes to the complexity of Israel as a society. You have all these unique situations that on a day-to-day basis, leaders have to contend with. I find it very interesting, and I think that we'll see over time that in order to defend and protect Israel, the ultra-Orthodox community will have to understand that their role is important in this. We'll see. We'll include some comments in the notes. Can I shift our conversation? We've been a little technical. I don't want to say
as always.
I've been reading some updates in the Israeli media about the Eurovision contest. We've talked about the Eurovision contest, I think, every year that it's been a part of our schedule of the podcast. Why is it a little bit more controversial this year than in previous years?
So this year's Eurovision, it was pretty interesting for Israel to have to think about, would we send a participant to the Eurovision with a war going on, with so many parts of the world having very negative views, to say the least, about Israel and our place in the world. And the decision was made that, yes, in fact, Israel wanted to send someone and that we would choose that person by having a sort of American Idol style competition, televised competition, to choose the person. And the young woman who won the competition, by the name of Eden Golan, with an interesting backstory herself, born in Israel, but family moved back to Moscow when she was a child, and she was raised there and only came back to Israel at the age of 18. She won, and the sponsors of Israel's participation in the Eurovision wrote two songs that were meant to be her competition songs. And the Eurovision committee, I guess, decided that the lyrics of the songs were too political and could not be accepted. This caused the complexity that you're referring to. And at first, the organizers from the Israeli side did not want to make these changes. They really wanted to say, this is our right to sing the songs as written. And if it means we can't participate, we won't participate. But President Herzog stepped in, and it's just so interesting because it's a singing competition. But in Israel, everything is political and everything is a big deal, and we're proud of the ways that we can be part of the world. But anyway, the president stepped in and said, listen, it is so important for Israel to be seen on the world stage this year. Would you reconsider? And yes, change the lyrics so that Israel can participate. And they agreed. So now the revised lyrics are being presented to the Eurovision committee and presumably will be accepted, and we will compete as planned. So that was a little bit of controversy. And we'll see how it goes. We will wish Eden Golan lots of luck, as Israelis have had quite a bit of in other years of the Eurovision.
I think, Liz, this is a very interesting story. Again, we discuss some of the most unique examples of Israel's character. And when the president of the country has to intervene on a song contest, I think it's very interesting. So I just pulled up.
All in a day's work. You got to think, what does the poor president have to do in any one given day?
I mean, one day he's at the Berlin Security Council meetings, The next day, he's discussing the song lyrics for the Eurovision contest. We should note that last year, Unicorn, I think, took third place in the Eurovision. I can't remember.
I think that sounds right. Yeah. Noah Carroll was the singer. Yeah.
So just a little bit of insight into this. So the original song was called October Rain, and with references to the war in Gaza. And the title and the lyrics were changed to Hurricane, along the same melodies as October Rain, but with different words. So I think it'll be interesting to see. Do you know when the Eurovision contest is?
I am. It's not so far off, but I don't remember the exact date.
Well, I'm sure that you will keep us informed of it. I just think of all the things that Israel is going through today. You know, there's still 134 hostages that we talked about at the beginning, day 150 of the war. And you had municipal elections. Now we're having the Eurovision discussion. What other topics are you seeing on the street or in life in Israel that you want to just kind of share with us as we conclude the podcast for today?
We're starting to see more forum preparations happening. Since that's just over 3 weeks away. And what else? We have officially reached the time in Israel where the time of year where one can have absolutely no idea what the weather has in store for the day. It's like one day winter, one day spring, and then it'll settle on itself probably next month. And what else are we seeing in Israel? I don't know. I think, regular life.
Sometimes we talk about the water level of the Sea of Galilee, of the Kinneret. Do you have any insight into whether it's risen or decreased in its water level? There's been a lot of rain in Israel. That's why I mentioned that.
Yeah, I don't feel like it's been a particularly rainy winter. I don't know. I'd have to check on that. I haven't heard anything about the level of the Kinneret, but we haven't had too much rain, so it might need some help.
Okay, well, more and more for us to talk about next week. Anything you want to say before we sign off?
Just wishing everyone a good and safe and healthy week.
I agree with you. And thank you all. This has been Israel Rebound, a podcast bringing exciting and interesting topics to our listeners from around the world. Thank you all for listening.